Rick Ganley with New Hampshire Public Radio News. It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. With Sunni militants from the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant pushing within 50 miles of Baghdad after routing national security forces in the northern cities of Mosul and Tikrit, Iraq appears poised on the brink of a full-scale sectarian civil war. While thousands of Iraqi citizens have answered a Shia religious leader's call to take up arms to protect Baghdad, it remains to be seen whether the Shia-dominated government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki can survive the crisis. Despite a no-boots-on-the-ground pledge by President Obama, the president has ordered U.S. military assets into the Persian Gulf as he contemplates possible airstrikes against the Sunni insurgents. The president has also deployed the Marines to beef up military security around the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, where thousands of American citizens staff the largest of our diplomatic facilities around the world. Nothing less than the decade-long investment of American blood and treasure in the future of Iraq is at stake. Today on The Exchange, we're taking a close look at the burgeoning crisis in Iraq. Let us hear from you. How do you think President Obama is handling the response to the growing crisis in Iraq? Do you think the U.S. should take additional military action to stop the insurgents? Have you or someone close to you served in Iraq? What do you think the future of our relationship with the Iraqi government should be? You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Or post a comment on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. I have two guests joining me for the show today. Joining me in studio is Wayne L'Esperance. Wayne is a professor of political science at New England College and director of the Center for Civic Engagement. Wayne, it's always good to see you.
Thanks, Dean. Thanks for having me.
And joining us on the line from Hanover, New Hampshire is Daniel Benjamin. He's director of the Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth College. He's also served as ambassador at large and coordinator for counterterrorism at the U.S. State Department. Ambassador Benjamin, thank you for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
Gentlemen, let's start by talking about the militant group that is driving the current crisis, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or as they're also known, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. Let me start with you, Ambassador Benjamin. What do we know about this group?
The Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant is the lineal descendant of al-Qaeda in Iraq. It has renamed itself, but it is essentially the group founded by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi in the early days of our presence in Iraq. It arose as a response to the occupation. Zarqawi himself was a Jordanian who whipped up a great deal of interest in the jihadist cause, and it is a group that has benefited tremendously from the civil war in Syria, where it has gained lots of fighters, and it has essentially become one of the main players in this large ungoverned space between central Iraq and really central or almost western Syria now. It's been very active. It's quite vicious. It's been largely disowned by al-Qaeda core in Pakistan because of its desire to kill other Muslims, particularly Shia, on the grand scale, and to some extent also because of its ambitions to create a state, which the al-Qaeda leadership doesn't think it's quite ready for. It doesn't take a lot of orders from al-Qaeda in Pakistan. It's been charting its own path pretty much since the days of Zarqawi.
So, Ambassador Benjamin, you mentioned that they were lineal descendants of al-Qaeda. In the media, I've heard the group described as al-Qaeda-inspired or an al-Qaeda splinter group. Some have said they're too extreme for al-Qaeda. So they were originally actually part of this group, and then they broke away. Is that correct?
This was originally al-Qaeda's affiliate in Iraq, which was set up once the U.S. forces moved in. Zarqawi himself had some training in Afghanistan. He had strong al-Qaeda connections. But at the same time, he was a pretty headstrong individual who decided he was going to do things his way. So there's always been a tension with al-Qaeda Corps, as we call it, which has been headquartered in the tribal lands of Pakistan. But there are a lot of ideological similarities and a lot of shared inspirations.
Wayne, too extreme for Al-Qaeda. Say a little bit about their military strategy.
Sure. And so this is something different than what we've seen with Al-Qaeda and similar organizations before. And I think, as the ambassador mentioned, you know, a desire to control territory. This is an organization that's not only taking towns and cities, but it's holding them. It's keeping them. It's in places in Syria that it controls, is building schools, is recruiting young boys, thinking about the next generation and generations of fighters. You know, just a moment about the leader, this fellow Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
Who apparently they had in custody.
In fact, there's a great interview with the colonel that was in charge of the military.
This is the U.S.
U.S. colonel, right, yeah. That had him in custody, described him as a savvy fellow but not particularly dangerous. That may be something he's reconsidering today. But here's a guy who reportedly has a Ph.D. in Arabic or Islamic studies. He's an Iraqi. He was a POW. His strategy has been very different. It is very brutal. We've all heard the stories. We've probably seen some of the images. But it's also about building this caliphate, this state that he wants. He claims to be a descendant of Muhammad, which has currency in this part of the world. He's also someone who's reportedly, this organization has assets worth $2 billion. They've taken oil fields. They've continued to conduct the business of selling oil and those sorts of things, in addition to capturing weapons and building this organization into what appears to be a state-like organization. They have their own judiciary. They're doing the kinds of things you would expect a government to do. So this is, you know, I guess the way I would say it, this is not our parents' Al-Qaeda. This is a different animal, and it's representing itself different on the battlefield.
Now, Ambassador Benjamin, Wayne mentioned that there's a very brutal group in their tactics, but I've also read that they're conducting a bit of a public relations campaign, at least with some of the Sunnis who have stayed in places like Tikrit and Mosul.
Right. Well, all terrorist groups, and Al-Qaeda is no exception, want to build a base and want to have a following, want to be able to recruit, want to be able to fundraise. And this is a group that aspires to lead the Sunni Muslims of the region. So it's not surprising that they're doing that. And I expect that they will continue to. They have adopted some of the techniques of other terrorist groups, some of them on the other side of the sectarian line, such as Hezbollah, in terms of trying to provide some social services. But I think one of the things that's important to remember is that it's not a very large group. It numbers in the thousands, not in the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands. And its ability to control and govern any of the areas it's captured or to really provide services on a large scale are really quite limited. As I understand it, their main tactic in terms of holding territory is pretty limited. They create councils when they occupy a town and put those folks in charge, and those councils may carry out some kind of retributive attacks against individuals, or may try to impose some kind of governance on the town. But it's very, very it's a very thin film of governance, if you will. And sometimes they'll come back through the town and carry out some revenge killings, things like that, to show who's boss. But their ability to really create a state is quite limited.
I guess, Wayne, the thinking is, you know, you provide a little fuel, a little food, a little electricity, and maybe you sort of win over the public a little bit. But it sounds like non-Sunnis have essentially fled some of these locations.
Well, and that's right. And so, you know, it's absolutely the case that, you know, the estimates, who knows really how many folks there are in this group, but the estimates are somewhere south of 10,000, right? So the question becomes is, well, then how have they been so successful in what they've managed to do? And the answer is that they have brought in folks who may not share their ideological point of view, fellow Sunnis, but who share a common fear of the government in Baghdad, who have seen how Sunnis have been increasingly marginalized, are afraid of the advance of Shiite empowerment and growth of Shiite power. throughout the country. So they have managed to join and form these loose coalitions to help them in these activities.
With these disaffected groups like the Hussein Baathists.
That's right. So former members of the Iraqi military, former supporters of the government. But beyond that, folks who are genuinely looking at Maliki and saying he doesn't have our interests at heart. He has broken the promises he made to the Americans when they left in terms of integrating these folks into the government. And the former vice president, whether he engaged in corrupt practices or not, just summarily thrown out and made a wanted man who is also a Sunni. So they sort of, I think the argument is that, look, our interests are better served at least hitching our wagon to this group now than it will be served by the Shiites.
Daniel, any sense that this is a group that can be negotiated with at some point?
Interesting question. I would have thought not in the sense that they're committing, you know, mass atrocities, that they've basically pushed themselves beyond the pale. You know, the UN this morning, I think, suggested or indicated that there had been atrocities carried out by the group. I think their agenda is would be quite difficult to integrate into any kind of negotiating strategy. And they are a designated terrorist group, so I think we'd have a hard time figuring out how we could make any arrangements with them. I think they'd have to renounce violence, and that's not something they're likely to do.
What do you think, Wayne?
I agree. I think that to the extent that you can undercut the success of this organization is you identify the groups that are supporting them, the other Sunni groups, and try to sort of pick them off, peel them away from supporting ISIS, and see if that will water down their strength, you know, and scale things back. But I don't think there's any – I don't see how we get to a table with folks who – are just so far apart from where we are on how to proceed.
And your sense real briefly about whether you think they're actually going to be able to get into Baghdad in the coming weeks.
I don't. I think Baghdad, the Shiite militias have reformed and now supporting Iraqi security forces. I think that that's a much tougher nut to crack. I don't think they get in.
We need to take a quick break, but we'll come back and talk more about the situation in Iraq. We'll talk about the U.S. response and some of the other big players in the region. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. The Exchange is coming to the North Country. Join Laura Kanoy and a panel of experts as they discuss the state of the Main Street economies north of the Notches. You can attend this special event at the Colonial Theater in Bethlehem on July 10th. Reserve your tickets at nhpr.org. Partly to mostly sunny across New Hampshire today. We'll have high temperatures in the 80s. Partly cloudy this evening, then mostly cloudy. Chance of showers and thunderstorms after midnight. Lows tonight upper 50s to mid 60s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from the New Hampshire Division of Economic Development, helping Granite State businesses grow and prosper, online at nheconomy.com. And from the Center for Bone and Joint Health, offering treatment for bone, joint, and muscle injuries to patients in Nashua and surrounding communities, centerforboneandjointhealth.org. It's 920. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis, and today on The Exchange, we're talking about the invasion of Iraq by Sunni extremists and the American response to it. You can call in and join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. Gentlemen, we're talking about the militant group, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or Iraq and Syria, depending on which name you use. Let's take a little bit of a step back and look at the other side of the equation. The Shia-dominated Iraqi government. And Ambassador Benjamin, let me start with you. Prime Minister Maliki's role in this, he's gotten a fair bit of criticism.
He deserves every bit of it. He has governed in a way that has guaranteed the outcomes we're seeing now. He has been a Shia chauvinist, a narrow-minded, really thuggish Shia politician throughout, and he is partly responsible for the military collapse because he viewed the military as a threatening institution and purged a lot of its best officers and promoted those who he felt he could rely on and who shared his religious background. He has hounded Sunni politicians out of Baghdad. Wayne mentioned what happened with the vice president. He has spurned every bit of advice from the United States and our European partners, countries around the world, about the need to govern inclusively, about the need to attend to the grievances and concerns of the Sunni minority, of the Kurds in the north. And he has really ignored those. And I have to say that since President Obama sort of laid down his message that we would help Iraq, but we weren't going to help a Maliki who continued to pursue these kinds of policies, he's still not done anything that suggests that he gets the message. He's been influenced a great deal by Iran. At many times, he's done Iran's bidding in terms of his relations with us, and he's bad news.
Wayne, your thoughts, and in particular, do you think there's any possibility that some other Shia politicians might push him out?
It's hard to say. He is already. The news today is very interesting to me. He's gone into sort of bunker mode. His senior team of his administration have shed the suits and are now putting on fatigues. They are in, you know, we're in a fight, and in many ways this is insulating for them because the more they can portray this crisis externally, the more likely the Shiites are going to rally around this particular leader. It would be in our interest if someone else that we could work with came forward, but the relationships with Iran, I think, are going to be very difficult to overcome and support for us. Let me just say one more thing, just how bad he has done. By the time the Americans left, the Islamic State of Iraq, the precursor group to what we're dealing with now, was largely eradicated. And the way that was done was the United States and its friends in the country managed to recruit 100,000 Sunnis to help put this organization down. We have lost all of that momentum. We have lost the support of those groups. They believe that they can't deal with the government. So you've seen a complete turnaround that now some of these folks who had helped put them down, that organization down, are now with them fighting against the regime. So this is a complete – incompetence almost sounds too kind, Dean. This is much worse than that.
Sounds pretty serious. Daniel, I've had trouble figuring out whether or not the Obama administration wants him out or they feel like he's their only real option at this point.
Well, first of all, on the question of whether there might be alternatives, you know, Iraq is actually forming a new government, and it is possible that his own party is going to push him out after after the failures that have been manifest recently. I don't – you know, there's always a challenge when you're trying to formulate policy, multiple challenges. One of them is that you want to respect democratic outcomes. And the Obama administration came under pressure from a lot of different friendly governments around the world to help push Maliki out and felt that that would be in contradiction of our support for democracy. At the same time, you know, he's the only person – he's the address right now in Baghdad. And he is the only person we have to deal with in the moment. And we're not in the business of arranging coups as we might have been during the Cold War. So there's going to be an awful lot of teeth gnashing and ambivalence and uncertainty as to whether any promises he makes are worth, you know, their paper they're written on. He has certainly burned most of his bridges with Washington. And if you've heard any of the comments of Secretary Clinton, for example, you'll know that this is a position that is widely held.
Yeah, I mean, that's very interesting. I had heard some rumblings that perhaps other Shia in the government might want to push him out when they form. Gentlemen, let's go to the phones. We have Bob calling in from Brookline. Bob, welcome to the exchange.
Thank you.
Your question, please.
My comment, and I'd like to hear the panel's consideration of Kurds. I served in Iraq and Afghanistan, still a military officer. My recommendation would not to go back, but certainly not to get involved in a Sunni-Shia conflict. And as I mentioned, as I heard the panel say, the Shia control of Iran, I would let Iran spend their blood and treasure in the conflicts south of Kirkuk. But if we were ever to support allies in the region, it would be either the Kurds or also make sure that Jordan was bolstered as a good ally. But I'd like to hear your panel's discussion about the options with the Kurds.
Great. Wayne, why don't you go first?
Sure. And so you have the Kurds as this ethnic community in the northern part of Iraq. They also, this community expands beyond that into Syria, into Iran, and into Turkey. And here's a group that has fought ISIS and has been, you know, fairly successful against them. They have taken some territory in the northern part, and there's no evidence that they will ever leave. So the relationship between the United States and the Kurds has been fairly positive in the aftermath of the war in Iraq. And I think that your caller is right, that there are opportunities there. But it's also complicated because there is a complicated relationship between the Kurds and our ally in Turkey. There's a complicated relationship between the Kurds and the states where they happen to be. Managing that is difficult. I think as we think about the future, though, I can't imagine that the successes that the Kurds have had in northern Iraq is anything that they're going to be willing to give up. And so when we think about what Iraq might look like in the future, you know, there's very serious talk about, you know, the Kurds' place in that calculation and whether or not there will actually be a state called Kurdistan.
Daniel?
Well, I think the caller's remarks were very well informed. You know, we're at a point where we're still trying to maintain considerable pressure on Iran. And so the thought of actually doing a lot of their business for them in Iraq strikes me as strategically questionable. That's why yesterday's news that we might have military discussions with them, I thought, was so off base, and in fact, the White House walked that back pretty quickly. You know, I think Wayne's got it right about the Kurds. I think that their relationship with Turkey has improved considerably. The Turks weren't as fast to come around to recognize the value of a Kurdish state in that very strategic area, but I think that over time, they may do so. The Kurds certainly look to be headed their own way. The oil deal that was struck with Baghdad is a perilous one, and Maliki has been holding back on paying the allotment, the dispersal that he's supposed to be with the Kurds. So they're at some point going to say, you know, we can do just fine with the oil we have here. We don't need a cut of the national pie. So I think the Kurds are an interesting case and probably will at some point want to slip the noose of the Sunni-Shia conflict. And, of course, the caller is absolutely right that we need to continue to strengthen Jordanian forces and Jordan's ability to deal with its very difficult situation with this enormous number of refugees that they have right now from the Syrian conflict.
And Daniel, what about Bob's second part of the question about letting, I believe he said, let Iran bear the cost in the south of dealing with the conflict?
Well, that's what I was alluding to at the beginning about saying we want to maintain leverage, so why not let them foot the bill and let them have a little overstretch in terms of sending their forces to deal this. But, you know, I think that that Washington at the end of the day will not want to go in that direction because of a number of perceptions. One is the United States has, as you said in your introduction, sunk an enormous amount of blood and treasure into the Iraqi project, and we're not prepared right now to walk away from the unitary state, and we'll continue to work to keep it together. And so the idea of letting Iran acquire so much more influence and make it so much more of a Shiite rump state is probably not something that policymakers want to go for right now. My guess is we're kind of stuck with the policy we have, but there are certainly strong arguments to be made for allowing Iran to shoulder more of the responsibility. You know, at the end of the day, Maliki may just decide to invite Iranian forces to support him anyway. There is not a beautiful relationship between Iraqi Shia and Iranian Shia. There is an Arab-Persian divide there. But if Maliki has his back to the wall, he may choose to go that way.
And Bob, thanks for that call and for sharing your experience as a veteran with us. If you're a veteran out there, you perhaps were deployed in Iraq, we'd love to hear from you. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. My guests today for the conversation in Iraq are Daniel Benjamin. He's director of the Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth College and a former ambassador at large at the U.S. State Department. And Wayne Lesperance, professor of political science at New England College and director of the Center for Civic Engagement at NEC. And Wayne, let me go to you. We have an email from Peter. It's a rather pointed email. I'll just read you the tagline and you can tell me what you think. At what point is enough just enough? Isn't there some point where you just cut your losses?
Well, I mean, Peter, I think that's a question that a lot of Americans are asking. You know, there's a balance between the sacrifices, the blood and treasure, as we keep saying, that have been expended on in Iraq, and the goals and what we believe were some successes achieved there, and trying to preserve that, versus what new investment of those things would it take to try to stop the current violence and get Iraq back on the right track. My own point of view, as somebody who has family members who have fought over there and served over there, as a family member who has come home permanently damaged as a result of his service, is, and this is just my point of view, is that without some clear path to victory, some identifiable goals, I don't believe the U.S. should get militarily involved. I don't think that we can stop the civil war that is actually happening and that is likely to continue. And I think by putting Americans in harm's way over there, we're not likely to achieve anything close to what most of us would think of as success. So, you know, it is a tragedy. I think it is terrible what is happening and what is probably going to get worse. But like Bob said a few moments ago, that, you know, if Iran has such a stake in this, let Iran bear the burden of this. My vote is to keep young Americans home.
And Ambassador Benjamin, what would be the impact of just cutting our losses?
One aspect of this that we haven't discussed is the domestic political one. And
that's and a that perfect is, segue.
And that is the really difficult part of this whole – one of the many difficult parts of this whole calculation. President Obama is under fire, I think unfairly so, from those who were highly supportive of the mission in Iraq. Senator McCain's been outspoken, has asked for the resignation of the entire national security team, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And so this is a new political football in Washington that I'm sure – the president could have done without. And what's more is no matter how much he disliked this war, thought it was, quote, a dumb war, and I have to say I agree with him on that, the notion of being the president who lost Iraq is going to not sit well in the White House. And there are going to be a lot of concerns about how this plays out in the midterms, how it plays out in the 2016 election. And so there is going to be a desire to do something to keep the ball moving and not to have a disaster played out across the pages of the newspapers and on the web as we go forward. So the president's in a really difficult situation. Additionally, you know, there is the oil matter. Iraq, I believe, has the second greatest proven reserves in the world. Yes, we're all pleased we have lots of shale hydrocarbons coming online, but I think it's a mistake to think that ISIS will be able to maintain or even want to maintain production. Now, a lot of the oil is coming out of the south, and there's no problem in Basra, but. A spike in oil prices is something that no government wants to see right now. It's a very complicated domestic issue. I think there are also going to be an awful lot of people who fought in Iraq who are going to question whether the administration has honored the sacrifice if it doesn't do something to hold the country together and get it back on the right path. I do think that Wayne's right in that the overall political sentiment will be, keep American boots off the ground. But it's interesting to note that Rasmussen, I think this morning or yesterday, had a poll suggesting something else. So I think it's a very confused electorate right now. And I think the White House is probably doing the right thing in letting things settle out a bit on the ground in Iraq and also in public opinion in the U.S.
And Wayne Daniel provided a perfect segue to where I want to go next, which is a discussion of the kind of domestic politics of this. I'm interested to hear your assessment of the political situation for President Obama. He has said no boots on the ground, although we're hearing that several hundred, they're typically called advisors, right, but they're special forces or CIA or some military who are going to be going over there to help out.
Right. So initially there is a group that's gone over to help shore up the embassy and to help to evacuate Americans should that need arise. We know that the George H.W. Bush, the carrier and some support vessels are being moved into the area. For an aircraft carrier to launch airstrikes, you need, forward observers, people to actually paint the targets, give them a place to drop their ordnance. So that means that, boots on the ground, however few, however small. And it's hard not to see this as a precursor to something bigger. But look, let me go back to domestic really quick. If we didn't have the problems we have with Syria, if we didn't have what the president's struggle with, Putin in Ukraine and Crimea, if we didn't have, the crisis, well, we didn't have the problems we have associated with the Veterans Administration. All of these things together get exactly to something that Daniel just said, and that is that, are these veterans, is their sacrifice being honored properly? And there's a narrative that the Republicans are pushing that is saying that it is not. And this becomes another piece of that narrative. I think it is colossally crazy to think that we are going to take on this group through airstrikes alone or through drone strikes. You can do some things. You can do some pinpricks there. But this isn't a conventional military force with large tank columns that are really vulnerable to airstrikes. This is a group that fights, in an irregular way. And so the way you deal with that is through, putting boots on the ground. That's what scares me, is that the political calculus here, the political power here, is going to push the president towards a decision that isn't a good one.
We need to take one more break, but after the break, we'll continue talking about the situation in Iraq. We'll take your calls, so stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, debate over how teacher tenure affects the quality of education. Then the novel Dr. Zhivago and a Cold War tale of literary espionage. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. New Hampshire weather for today, partly to mostly sunny. We'll have high temperatures in the 80s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Dartmouth Hitchcock, primary care doctors and nurses who put you at the center of health. 13 locations statewide, information at d-hdocs.org. And Edward Jones, a financial services firm serving individuals and business owners. Edward Jones, making sense of investing, a member of SIPC. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange, and I'm Dean Spiliotis. Tomorrow on The Exchange, invasive species and their threats to New Hampshire. But today in The Exchange, we're talking about the latest events in Iraq. You can join us with your thoughts by calling in at 1-800-892-6477. You can find us on Twitter at NHPR Exchange or find us on Facebook at NHPR Exchange, all one word, to continue the conversation. And gentlemen, I want to talk a little bit more about the U.S. context. And Ambassador Benjamin, we've heard some talk about a status of forces agreement or the inability to reach one. And perhaps you could explain for our listeners what exactly that means. I've heard some Republicans in Congress say, if we had left 15,000 troops in Iraq, this wouldn't be happening, but they couldn't get that agreement.
Right. Well, so there was a status of forces agreement that was negotiated with Baghdad and I believe signed in 2007, 2008. And that required that it would be renegotiated in 2011. And under such agreements, typically, and this is the case in every one of them I know of, the host government agrees to provide a set of immunities for U.S. forces who are stationed in this country from prosecution by the judicial authorities of that country. And it's very important because our forces can be the target of all kinds of arbitrary and capricious actions by local and state governments, or federal governments, national governments, as you like. And this has been something that the U.S. military has depended on around the world. And there's a very good piece on exactly this issue by Colin Kahl, who was the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for this region in Politico. And he talks about the troubles they had getting this. And the cold, hard fact is that the Iraqi parliament was not going to ratify a SOFA agreement. And it seems pretty clear that Maliki himself was not terribly interested in it. At this point, he wasn't, I guess, worried about any insurrection. And in fact, the surge had done a pretty good job of tamping down the insurrection and probably giving Maliki a false sense of security. So there was no SOFA agreement concluded, and the United States pulled out its troops, as we all know. And this has become a contentious point in the political debate, with a lot of Republicans arguing that the White House wanted out of Iraq and didn't go the distance in terms of the negotiations. And in fact, I was on Al Jazeera yesterday and had a former Bush official make exactly this claim. And I think it's just completely specious. I think the Iraqis were listening to their friends, their neighbors in Tehran, who wanted the U.S. out of the region. And that certainly with the Shia community, the majority of the Shia community in Iraq, there was a strong desire to see U.S. forces go. And that's Maliki's constituency, and he was listening to them. So, you know, I think it's a rather absurd contention. But truth value, of course, is not the test of what wins in the political debate.
Wayne, if we had kept those troops in there, 15,000, let's say, would it have made a difference? Would this be happening now?
Maybe. I mean, you know, it's hard to imagine the ISIS enjoying the military success that it did. But, you know, it also opens up the possibility that you would have seen greater consternation and perhaps even political violence from Shiite militias in the south, objecting to the prolonged American presence there. So, you know, this kind of, you know, speculation, who knows? That, you know, I tend to agree that I don't think it's fair to put this on the current president. I think it was very clear that the Iraqis wanted the Americans out, that the parliament wasn't going to pass it, and that Iran was very keen on getting the Americans out of the region as well. So I think those factors aligned themselves, and we got out.
Now, Wayne, you're an election guys like me. Let's talk a little bit about the Democrats and Republicans in Congress and the midterm. How is this playing in both parties? I have heard some Democrats call for military action. I think, as Ambassador Benjamin mentioned, you know, the Democrats sort of ran on a platform of getting out of Iraq. But some stuff, there's some split going on in the Republican Party as well, correct?
Right. I mean, there's sort of the Rand Paul wing of the party that says we don't want to, you know, what are we doing? Why would we consider getting involved? John McCain is off the reservation on this. Then there are, you know, even John McCain and his buddy, his best pal, Lindsey Graham, are split.
What are they saying?
Well, you know, again, measuring what we know, John McCain famously saying, you know, we need to get involved, you know, hot and heavy, use force, whatever it takes. Lindsey Graham, I think, has tried to strike a more cautious approach and is questioning whether there's value in that. So there's a spread in the Republican Party on this. And I think among Democrats, there's a tremendous irony here that the issue that brought, in many ways, Barack Obama to the presidency, this same country seems to be causing, you know, potential problems for Democrats going forward. So you see Democrats who are in fairly conservative or moderate districts trying to manage or balance this issue on whether or not there should be the use of force or what should the United States do. In many ways, it's too soon to tell. I mean, any polls that come out now, I think, voters are reacting to the images they're seeing and to the shocking nature in which this has all happened, at least in their minds. We'll see in a few weeks, months, what transpires and whether there's any sort of, you know, gelling of attitudes around what the United States should do and which party is able to capture that. But I think the president is in a very tough spot here. One last thing. I was listening to Morning Joe this morning, Dean, and Joe Scarborough says a lot of things. One of the things he said today that really struck me as true was that this country, Iraq, it has been damaging to Republicans. It has been damaging to Democrats. It manages to sort of get everybody at some point in their time there. And I think at this point, the president is sort of dealing with that challenge now.
Ambassador Benjamin, you spend a few minutes listening to talk radio or watching cable news, and you hear Democrats say this is all George W. Bush's fault. If you listen to Republicans, you hear them say this is President Obama's fault. Your take on the kind of the politics of this?
Well, so the politics are pretty ridiculous with so much finger pointing going on. But let me talk about the realities as I see them.
Sure.
A lot of what is going on in Iraq is the expression of very large forces at work in the region. There has been a growing sectarian divide in Southwest Asia and the broader Middle East now for almost 40 years. It's been, in fact, about 40 years. It really started with the Iranian Revolution. And it has been building for some time. And the but a triggering event, I think we'd all have to agree, was the invasion of Iraq in 2003. And the reason I say it's a triggering event is because it fundamentally changed the equilibrium between Sunni and Shia in the region. And it caused a lot of Sunnis to harbor a grievance that a major country in that region, admittedly one that had been ruled by one of the worst tyrants of modern times, but he was a Sunni tyrant, that this country had been moved from the Sunni column to the Shia column. And as a result, when you get the kind of intersecting energies of the Arab Spring, Sunnis are looking for payback in Syria. And the thought of taking down Iran's one close ally and its window on the west in the Levant, that becomes an enormously powerful inspiration. And as a result of this, you know, the jihadist groups are drawn into Syria. You see enormous numbers coming to fight there, foreign fighters, many more than we saw come to Iraq in 2003, many more than we saw come to Afghanistan beginning in 2001. And so we have a clash here that is of really large proportions, very hard for anyone to steer. I think even the countries that have propagated it, in particular the Gulf Arabs in Iran, are not able to really control what has been let loose. So, you know, it's a case in which there were large historical developments and they were, in a sense, turbocharged by what happened with the invasion of Iraq.
So, Daniel, it sounds like given the complexity of the scenario you just described, that my sense of your thoughts is that the kind of partisan overlay we're seeing in this country really kind of misses the bigger point here.
Doesn't it always?
that's another show.
Sure. Sure. It does miss the point. It also is, you know, it's about the blame game. It's about scoring points. It's not really about coming up with a solution. It's also not recognizing the really big realities. I'm not saying I have a solution for this, but I think that we do need to readjust our understanding of politics in the Middle East to take in account this large sectarian dimension, which is not just about Sunni and Shia fighting in Syria and Iraq. And let me just add one more thing.
Sure.
As we think about all that, you know, the one really big consequence for the United States is that there is now this vast under or ungoverned area in the region, reaching really from the outskirts of Aleppo to Fallujah, in which terrorist plotting can go on in. And it's my view that allowing ungoverned spaces and terrorist safe havens to emerge is a big, big problem and a real taboo in politics, but it's in international politics, but it's happened again. And this is going to pose a significant long-term threat to the United States. And that's really why we should care about the outcome in Iraq and why, although I completely agree we don't want boots on the ground, at the end of the day, the administration may decide that it would conduct airstrikes just to take more jihadis off the field. And I do think that at some point this is going to be a major focus of our counterterrorism efforts.
Wayne, we have an email here that kind of takes us back to our earlier discussion in the show of what this militant group is doing in the cities in terms of dealing with citizens. And Jade writes, how are Iraqi women faring in this occupation, both in the refugee camps and in fallen cities? If Baghdad falls to ISIS, that's the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, what does her future look like? And Jade is writing in from Hinsdale.
Well, Jade, I think you're onto something. I think you can imagine what it's like for Iraqi women who fall under control of this group. They're covered from head to toe. Their faces are covered. You know, the directive in terms of this particular version of Sharia or Islamic law is that women should stay home, out of sight, not unless they absolutely have to be out. They shouldn't be out for sake of modesty and things like that. So this is certainly not a progressive organization interested in women's empowerment, education, and women's rights. You know, and I think we can imagine that this is going to be increasingly hard on the women of Iraq. And Iraq has been historically a country that has been fairly progressive when it comes to women's rights.
Continue.
Well, I was going to jump in a little bit on what Daniel
sure,
was just
absolutely.
Saying. I think Daniel said something that's really important, and it's an incredibly honest thing for someone to say, and that is, you know, he said something to the effect that I don't have a solution for this. And I think in the United States, that's something that politically we never hear someone say. Sometimes the hardest thing to say for government is that there isn't a good option here.
Right. You often hear, we need to do something.
That's right. And sometimes doing nothing is the best thing. And in this case, you know, the broader questions, and I'm sure we'll get to this, is really important. So you have Assad in Syria saying, look, if you get rid of me, this is what you're going to unleash in Syria. You have people looking at Afghanistan and saying, what does Afghanistan look like when the Americans leave? Is it going to be this? Is it going to be another civil war? Is it going to be all those sacrifices again going to be lost? You have all of these challenges and probably what's going to be a full-blown civil war, I would guess, in Iraq. And so this is only going to get more difficult. This is a really tough set of circumstances for the president and his team to navigate. And it's really sad in a sense that partisanship is dominating the discussion of this when it really it shouldn't. This is incredibly complex stuff.
Yeah. Ambassador Benjamin, we heard earlier some discussion about letting Iran bear the cost of this, but it sounds like in the news reports that there is a little bit of a dance going on between U.S. advisors and officials and Iranian officials. How do you see that interaction playing out? Do you think we're going to work with them or what?
An important thing to keep sight of here is that we are trying to close out this negotiation on the Iranian nuclear program. And that adds another element of complexity in all of this. And so I think that it is appropriate for U.S. officials to exchange views on what's going on in Iraq with Iranian diplomats, as I think they are right now. You know, there may be an element of this that actually helps those negotiations. President Rouhani has talked about the ability to get this done by the deadline. I believe it's July 20th or 21st. That is the negotiations. And I know that the Obama administration is deeply concerned, really wants to get this done, but there are a lot of outstanding problems. So I think it's a moment when the administration wants to keep the atmospherics with Iran in a good place. This is a major issue in national security, a major issue for the region. And it doesn't sit exactly well with what we're seeing going on in Iraq because at the same time we're not eager to have Iran extend its influence. But this is a case where you have to keep more than one ball in the air.
Wayne, your thoughts on Iran?
We're going to have to at least consult. I mean, they're already Iranian. You know, they say something like 500 Revolutionary Guards. This is sort of Iranian special forces guys who are now in country training, helping. That number can grow. So, you know, whether we are cooperating or at least consulting, those are two very different things. Some level, some version of this has to happen.
So do you foresee some, not necessarily military cooperation, but, you know, perhaps I've heard people talk about both Iran and the U.S. having their, you know, military planes on the same tarmac, something like that.
That's really hard to imagine. But here's the thing, sure. Dean. If at the end of the day this leads to greater levels of communication between Washington and Tehran on a variety of issues, that's not a bad thing.
Daniel, any final thoughts on where this is headed over the next few weeks? Is it going to start to slow down, or are we going to continue to see quick movement?
Right. Well, the crystal ball is the cloudiest of political instruments. But I would think that ISIS slows down. It can't control the territory it has. It's going to come up against a harder force in the Shia militias that are being mustered around Baghdad, Samarra, Karbala, and Najaf. And so I think that we head back towards a more familiar kind of stalemate. I think that also reduces the pressure on the U.S. to act. But, you know, we've been surprised time and again, and we need to be prepared for more surprises.
That's right. Well, we are out of time, and we're going to be watching the situation in Iraq develop very closely in the coming days. I'd like to thank my guests for joining us this morning. Wayne, it's always great to talk to you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
That's Wayne L'Esperance, professor of political science at New England College and director of the Center for Civic Engagement. And Ambassador Benjamin, thanks so much for sharing your unique perspective with us.
Oh, it's really been enjoyable. Thanks very much.
Thank you. That's Daniel Benjamin, director of the Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth College and an ambassador at large, former ambassador at large for the U.S. State Department. Dan joined us from Hanover, New Hampshire. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers, Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
We're all New Hampshire. Whether you live in the bustling southern tier or deep in the North Woods, there are issues that concern everyone in the Granite State. Whether it's taxes, town meetings, or traditions we hold dear, the conversations on The Exchange connect our state. And you're part of it with your calls and emails. I'm Laura Kanoy, host of The Exchange. Join me weekday mornings live at 9 here on NHPR.
Diane Rehm shows next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners. And support also comes to us from Grupponi Automotive, proudly celebrating 90 years of family-owned service in 2014 with a sales approach designed with guests in mind. Info and at Grupponi.com. And the Centennial Hotel at 96 Pleasant Street in Concord, featuring 32 rooms for travelers and 4 meeting rooms for corporate functions. Information at thecentennialhotel.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Tom Gelton of NPR, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Last week in California, a judge ruled that the state's teacher tenure laws are unconstitutional. He said the system discriminates against children from low-income families. The decision is the latest battle in a movement to weaken teacher tenure across the country. It's a battle that often pits